Does anybody know what the speed of sound is?
7.61.
Very good. 7.61 miles per hour. Actually, I'm told it depends a little bit on the temperature and the surrounding atmosphere, but we won't quibble about that. There was a film came out in 1952 called Sound Barrier. You probably didn't see it, and if you did, you will have forgotten, so we'll assume that nobody's seen it. It starred Ralph Richardson and Anne Todd, and it was based on a story written by Terence Rattigan, who also did the screenplay. It was about the first test pilot to break the sound barrier. Now, for a long time, many people didn't believe it was possible to break the sound barrier. Some people thought the plane would disintegrate because there are great forces, great vibrations as you go through it. Well, in the film, various pilots took their planes up to that magic figure, and sure enough, there were a number that crashed and none of them could get through it because, for one thing, the controls didn't seem to be working properly. Well, it was a very exciting film, so I'm told. At the climax, and one test pilot, Philip Peel, worked out what he thought would work because he, as guessed, worked out, had a hunch, that when the plane went through the sound barrier, the controls started to work backwards. Instead of pulling the stick forward to make the nose go up, when you did that, the nose went down. So he went, got up to the sound barrier in the plane, and as he went through it, he pulled the stick back. And instead of it nose going up, the plane... Oh, I got it the wrong way around, haven't I? Instead of pulling the stick back, he pushed it forward, and the plane should have gone down and gone into a dive. But instead, it went up, and he flew on safely, faster than anybody had flown before. Of course, if you'd had plenty of money, you could have broken the speed of sound. You could have gone on Concorde. Any time between 1976 and 2003, you could have flown faster than the speed of sound, which must have been very exciting. Has anybody been on Concorde? Bit expensive. Well, no, that was my line. Hang on. I've actually been on it twice. But it was on the ground each time. Before it went into service, one of the first ones that were produced came to Castle Donington, as it was known then, East Midlands Airport now. And those people who worked at Rolls-Royce who wanted to could go and get on board. So I hadn't actually had anything to do with producing the engines, but I wanted to go and have a look. I was very underwhelmed, actually, by what it was like inside. It was just like a cheap, old-fashioned sort of coach. It was tiny. And then, yes, as Brian said, we both went on it long after it had gone out of service in the Scottish Museum of Flight. Still very underwhelmed, but what a beautiful plane. So going back to the film, you won't be surprised to know that it wasn't quite historically accurate, but it does make a great point. The whole of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus was taking the controls and make them work backwards. Or what we sometimes say, he was turning the world's values upside down. If you've been here for the past two Sundays, you'll know by now that what we call a Sermon on the Mount is a long, long sermon, not as long as this one's going to be if you read it quickly. It takes up three chapters in Matthew's Gospel, and it was almost certainly a collection of Jesus' teachings given at various times that Matthew put together. 2 weeks ago, we heard Tim Morris talk about the blessings that we know as the Beatitudes. And last week, we heard about our calling to be salt and light. So this week, we're looking at Jesus' teachings on relationships, which you heard all about in the readings. When I first started to think about this service, felt maybe I'd drawn the short straw, because talking about murder, adultery, divorce and oaths, it actually sounds more like the storyline of some television drama than it does about a sermon. Now we're going to think first of all about what Jesus had to say about these four things, murder, adultery, divorce and oaths. But then we're going to think about what these teachings have to say about to us, about our attitudes, our relationships and our love for God and for other people. Because Matthew was writing primarily to the Jews, he referred very frequently throughout the Gospel to the Old Testament prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. And he tells of Jesus' words when he said that he came not to do away with the law God gave to Moses, what we know as the Ten Commandments, but to fulfill it. So in our passage, each time Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said," followed by, "But I tell you," he wasn't doing away with the law or adding his own beliefs to it. Rather, he was giving a fuller understanding of why God made that law in the first place. He raised the old commandments to a new level, telling his disciples not only to obey the commandment, but also to get rid of the feelings and attitudes that might otherwise lead to them violating the commandments. Jesus is trying to bring his disciples into compliance, not just with the letter of the law, but with the will of God that inspired the law. So we're going to talk first about murder. Of course, none of you would murder anyone, would you? I sincerely hope not. But you might, in that case, think, well, this commandment doesn't apply to me, so I'll just go on and read the next one. But Jesus said, not only should we not murder, we shouldn't even become angry enough to murder, because then we'll have committed murder in our heart. Well, the Pharisees knew this law very well. And as they hadn't literally murdered anyone, they thought, well, that's all right, doesn't apply to us. And they felt very righteous about it. And yet they were angry enough with Jesus to very soon start to plot his death. So we're called on not only not to murder, but to avoid anger, hatred, revenge, criticism, discouragement, putting people down, treating them with contempt, plotting against them. Instead, we're to be reconciled to them. Sounds easy, doesn't it? It can be hugely costly and difficult to do it. It'll almost certainly mean climbing down off the pedestals we've put ourselves on, abandoning our positions of superiority over the person we're angry with. And of course, anger, criticism, all these other things don't just hurt the person we're angry with, but they can hurt other people around us, and they can hurt us. I want to give you an example of how our anger can hurt other people. There was a husband and wife who'd been quarrelling for quite a long time, and one night, it really came to a head, and the man shouted and stamped his foot and said, "I hate you. I'm not having this anymore. No, no, no." Well, somehow they managed to stay together. But a few months later, in the middle of the night, the husband heard their young son, who was only very young, and he heard from his bedroom a strange noise coming. So he got out of bed, went to his bedroom, stood outside the door and listened. And this little boy was saying, "I hate you. I'm not having this anymore. No, no, no." And he realised then that he and his wife's anger with each other had been heard by the little boy and had affected him badly. Right, the next topic is adultery. In case you can't see very clearly, because the hands are rather pale pink, there's husband and wife, but the husband's holding hands with another lady behind his wife's back. Jesus said, "You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery." And as with murder, it would be very easy to say, "Well, I've never committed adultery and I'm not going to, so it doesn't apply to me." But Jesus broadens it. "I tell you, anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." The story of David and Bathsheba is a good example of what can happen. David saw Bathsheba bathing on her roof. Doesn't seem the most sensible place to bathe when the palace overlooked it, but still. He lusted after her and he committed adultery with her. But then he had to get rid of her husband, Uriah. A slippery slope had started. And then his firstborn was killed by God as punishment for what he'd done. And it left a great stain on David's reputation. Well, the Old Testament law said that it was wrong for a person to have sex with someone other than his or her spouse. But Jesus said the desire to have sex was just as bad. Jesus emphasized that if the act is wrong, then so is the intention. To be faithful to your spouse with your body, but not with your mind, is to break the trust, which is so vital to a good marriage. Well, today, things have changed a lot, haven't they? Society would lead us to believe that adultery is the norm. Only killjoys tell us that it's wrong. If no one knows about it, it's not going to hurt anybody, is it? Society doesn't just permit adultery. It encourages it. Look at all the temptations everywhere we look. Scantily dressed women on posters. Even some scantily dressed men these days. Of course, not everybody will identify with the need to avoid adultery. Especially perhaps those of us who, shall I say, are of a certain age. Becomes less of a problem as we get older. But it isn't just about sexual attraction. It's about controlling our thoughts, honouring our relationships. Because again, we can cause harm to ourselves and to others when we crave for things we can't have or compromise special trusts. So let's move on to divorce, which I suppose is a good topic to go on to after adultery. Jesus said, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery." Well, divorce is a very sensitive subject because many of us have been affected by it, either by going through it or by suffering or witnessing the damage that it does in families and friends. It's also a subject that arouses strong feelings, particularly amongst Christians. Not least because Jesus' teaching about it seems so uncompromising. And there are probably times when this has concerned many of us. Scripture consistently communicates that marriage is a lifelong commitment. Jesus described it later in Matthew's Gospel as "they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate." Jesus gave only one exception to that statement. it's permissible in the case of sexual immorality on the part of one's spouse, that is, adultery. Divorce in such cases is permissible, but it's not required. It isn't even encouraged. Forgiveness and reconciliation should be extended and pursued if at all possible. Now, Paul adds a second exception. In instances where an unbelieving spouse abandons the marriage, which would typically be the case if neither had been Christians when they married, but one person became a Christian and after marriage, and the other person refused to continue in the marriage because of that. We actually know someone that happened to. And he is now married to a lovely Christian lady. We could see these sort of statements as applicable more broadly to other situations that may not be directly mentioned by Scripture. For example, if a husband has been beating his wife, what does that say about the two becoming one flesh? And today, most people in our society will see divorce as regrettable, but sometimes necessary, or at least permissible. I read the other day about a busy mother who asked her husband to look after their 9-year-old boy for half an hour while she got on with some jobs. Well, he wasn't really all that pleased at having to do that because he'd got plans for himself. So he had a quick think and then he said to his son, "Tell you what, let's make our own jigsaw, shall we?" And he got a picture of the world out of a magazine and he cut it up and gave it to his son and said, "I'm just going off into the other room to do one or two things while you put that together. Come and tell me when you've finished." I thought, that'll take him at least half an hour. Well, it wasn't many minutes later when the little boy came and said, "I've done it, Daddy." "What? You can't have done." So he went through and had a look, and sure enough, the little boy had got this picture of the world put back together again. "Well, how did you do that?" And the little boy said, "Well, I noticed before you cut it up that there was a man and a woman on the other side of the picture. And I thought, if I put the man and the woman back together, then I could put the world back together at the same time. If I put the man and woman back together, I could put the world back together at the same time." Sort of out of the mouths of babes and sucklings, well, at least a 9-year-old boy. But of course, we're not just thinking about divorce here. We're thinking about the breaking up of any relationship. Perhaps too many people are in a relationship for what they can get out of it, rather than for what they can put into it. And as Christians, we're meant to put other people's needs before our own. And don't we often hear of friends falling out, brothers and sisters falling out, just because they couldn't agree on something, often something fairly trivial, or because one let the other one down, or one hurt the other one, and they wouldn't apologise. And you weren't going to forgive them, were you, if they didn't apologise? But again, reconciliation, restoration of that relationship is what we should be aiming for. And the fourth topic, oaths. Jesus said, "Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'Do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made.' But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all." And then he goes on to say, all we need to say is simply yes or no. And James says much the same thing. "But most of all, my brothers and sisters, never take an oath by heaven or earth or anything else. Just say a simple yes or no so that you will not sin and be condemned." Jesus is again broadening the scope of the ancient teaching, saying that we should be trustworthy enough that an oath, a bond, a promise isn't necessary. People should be certain that we would do what we said, just because we said we would. In fact, there's a website called Because I Said I Would. I had a look at that. It encourages people to keep their word and gives some inspirational examples of people who did keep their word, often in very difficult and painful circumstances for them. And one example I found was Abraham Lincoln. He was well known for never touching a drop of alcohol. There was a well-known story where a military colonel asked him if he would have a drink with him. And Abraham Lincoln said, "Well, when I was 9, my mother was on her deathbed and she called me in. And she said she wanted me to tell her that I would never take a drop of alcohol. And I promised her. And I have kept that promise ever since. Do you want me to break it now in order to have a drink with you?" And the colonel said, "Oh no, I only wish that when I was young, I'd made my mother a promise like that and stuck to it." So we've looked at the four things: murder, adultery, divorce, and oaths. But I want now to go on to talk about relationships. Broken relationships can hinder our relationship with God. They go against God's command to love, "As I have loved one another." Sorry, "As I have loved you, you must love one another." It's all about obeying the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law, which Jonathan talked to us earlier, which is brilliant. It's all about our attitude towards God and towards other people, about our relationship with God and with other people, about loving God and loving one another. Throughout the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is calling to us to change our thinking and our actions. When Tim was talking about the first part of the Sermon on the Mount, he called it Jesus' mission statement. And now I'm wondering, was it Tim or was it John Deister last Sunday? It doesn't matter. And we're to make a difference for God in our lives. We need to start by making small differences, small changes in our own lives. We might not commit murder or stab someone literally in the back, but we might ruin someone's efforts or reputation through what we say. We might not lust after anyone, but we might covet something inappropriate and harmful. We might not go through or cause a divorce, but we might damage a relationship by unsuitable behaviour. We might not take an oath or make a promise and break it, but we might fail to do something we said we would. So, going beyond the minimum required. How often have we heard someone say, or even said ourselves, "Well, I did what was required. I didn't do anything wrong. I obeyed the law, or I stuck to the rules," when actually more was required, should and could have been done. We're told not to do anything to hurt anybody, but that's negative, isn't it? How much better to think of doing something good for people, which is positive. We're told even to do good to our enemies. We need to go the extra mile, to love sacrificially, even if it hurts us. Some of the things that Jesus asks us to do, such as being reconciled with someone, seem impossible. But following his example, and in the power of the Holy Spirit, we can know that nothing is impossible. So to sum up, we are accountable to God for our thoughts and attitudes as well as our actions. Jesus calls us to new attitudes, new relationships, and new ways of loving. And although we may struggle to achieve this, we can remember that although we often fail to keep our promises, our God never fails to keep his.